Mr. Hannah, can you just tell us what it was like growing up in the Whiteford area, such as your schools and your family?
Well, as you probably noticed, I really grew up in the Whitehall area, which is a little bit further away. But I was born in 1910 in a cold winter night. I don't know how I survived, but on December 24, 1910, on a farm, medium-sized farm, general farming, sort of way we spoke of it, almost a subsistence farming. Not much cash was handled, but we had plenty of food and plenty of everything we needed. All the work on the farm was done by horse-drawn equipment. We plowed the fields with a single-bottom plow with two horses, and prepared the ground with horses, raked the hay and bunched it and put it on the wagon with forks. Everybody had a few cows, and at that time, in my earliest memory, the cream was sold. It was all skimmed off and sold to the creameries. And there was creamers in most every big neighborhood. And the skim milk was fed to the hogs. And the principal source of meat was hogs, too, and they were rendered when the weather got cold enough to take care of the meat. They were rendered up and canned, some of it, and of course salted and cured. And that was the principal source of meat. There wasn't much fresh meat to be had. We walked to school for about a mile across country to a one-room school where I started my training. And later I went to Jarrettsville High School. You've probably heard of that. I finished there in 1928, and my major was baseball. That was my favorite extracurricular activity. Well, I don't know. There's lots of other things that took place on the farm in those days. Every neighbor helped each other, and no hard help hardly. The boys, family boys did the work, and when it came time to thrash, well, the neighbors all came together and thrashed. No combining at that time, of course, hadn't been heard of. We had a binder which bound the sheaves up in the strings. They were hauled to a thresher. What else would you like to know?
Or just what it was like growing up, maybe some experiences you had in your free time, like in the winter, after most of the farming was done, or maybe some of your chores on the farm, the type of work you did there.
Milking cows was one of the chores everybody took part in because it was hand done, and learned very early how to milk a cow, feed horses and feed chickens, and had all the eggs we needed from the hens we had. And in the spring, of course, we had the new fryers that came along. That's about the only time we had fried chickens when they came ready. But wintertime, we'd enjoy the snow, you know. It seemed like the more I tell about it, the deeper the snow got, you know, the longer it is. But we did have deep snows in those early years in my memory. Lots of ice storms. And we'd walk to school, even though it was snowing or not, over this mile across country. Some of it would hit a part of a road, but it was all dirt road, of course. And by the way, there's no improved roads except the scraping by the county and the state. There's no hard surface roads in the neighborhood. And of course, when it got a little rainy, had pretty deep ruts. And of course, when it came along to get cars and the teens, they had a little trouble getting through the ruts. What else would you like to hear?
Maybe what was your home like? Maybe your brothers?
Oh, yes. I was probably a disappointment to my mother because she already had two boys. But they never let me know it in a way. They treated me like one as well as the others. I had two brothers, and we were one-third of the baseball team. And of course, we played together every waking hour. We'd be playing baseball. We'd shorten our lunch hour at school to play. And we were fortunate enough to become county champions in Jacksonville 3 years in a row, consecutively. 26, 27, 28. But from there, of course, I went on to University of Maryland and completed my bachelor's degree there in 32 and a master's degree in 33. Jobs, that was at the peak, I mean, that was at the depth of the Depression at that time. Wasn't any jobs to be had, hardly. So I took advantage of that and went back for another year. But get back on the farm you were thinking about, it was pretty, we thought, we didn't know we were having a hard time. We all liked what we were doing, you know. Everybody kept busy enough to be, we didn't know we were poor. Because everybody else is the same way. But we were never too poor not to have plenty of everything we needed, in clothing and food. And this one-room school was an interesting thing. We'd play there at the lunch hour, way down through the woods, you know, in the lunch hour, and go playing fox and geese and whatever you have you. And it was very rural. Everybody knew everyone. I don't know what, but I kept that off a while. I should have had notes to tell you all the things that happened in those years, I guess. Do you have any other questions?
Oh, about your schooling anyway. What was some of the courses they had in the one-room school, and what was that like?
The one-room school, you, for 7 years, no, wait a minute, excuse me, 7 years, you heard all the classes, of course. One went to front of the school to have his lesson heard. You would hear all those classes. And, of course, in your first grade, it didn't mean much to you. But when you got a little further along, you heard some of the stuff repeated several times, you know. But when you got to it, you'd get two. I don't know whether I was fortunate or what have you, but we have spelling bees, you know. And that was very interesting. Everybody, the whole school would line up on either side of the room and spell to the missed one. And the last one remaining would be the winner. I've had fortune enough to be winner there one time, if I recall. The word I never forget. Incidentally, they saw fit to pass me by the third grade. I didn't have to go to the third grade. I went from the second to fourth. So that shortened up my school age a little bit. So it was at 7 grades in that all those little room schools. It was 50 some of them in the county, I guess, at the time. 7 grades, then you went on to high school if you were so inclined. Only a small portion went on to high school.
How about high school, the one that you attended in Jarrettsville? How was that different from the elementary school? Then what was that like?
Well, in high school, of course, we had teachers for each different subject. And we'd move about in the building from one room to another. Of course, we had the usual courses like math and English, geography, and then when I was there, I took agriculture courses also. And physical ed wasn't in the program at all. Everybody played plenty without having it. And of course, we had French, no other foreign language at that time. So we went from one grade to another until we got through 11, only 11 grades at that time, to 8 to 11 on the high school side. And a few of us are fortunate enough to graduate. Mine was a large class. I often say the largest class at that time, up to that time, was so many people held back and just happened to finish it that year. Well, sir?
Can you tell us what your parents were like, how they raised you, and maybe some of their attitudes or personality?
Well, my parents were very strong to keep me in, us, I should say, in school every day we possibly could make. And one of the strong points they knew was arithmetic. They were sure that we learned arithmetic. And of course, our grade teacher made a point of our learning arithmetic too. She was very long on long division, made desk work and things for kids when they weren't busy with something else. You can make a long division problem quite lengthy, you know, and it occupied a lot of desk time. But they did encourage us to go to elementary school all the time and also high school. I think that college was pretty much determined. I made up my mind on that, perhaps. They didn't push me into it. But yes, they were very close to the little school, had socials there occasionally, so all the parents were acquainted, and acquainted with the teacher, and the teacher let them know how they're doing. So it was pretty close-knit circle, and the parents knew as well as anyone how we were doing, whether we told them the facts or not, you know. We didn't call it PTA, but they did have meetings occasionally and social events in the little run-room school. Now, of course, the walking to the school occupied a good bit of our time. And along the way, we'd walk with other people, other kids that were going the same direction, you know. So that was almost a social event just to go and come. So, I don't know what to say about that early farm life, but it was all handwork and horsepower. Thank you. I don't know what else you'd like to hear, but I know.
How about your college? What was that like, some of the courses and the different changes you saw there?
Well, I saw we had to form better study habits to keep up. Of course, we had started off with the freshman year. Chemistry was one thing that killed off a lot of them our first year, and so did English. Composition and rhetoric, they called it, the freshman class. And that was a pretty severe course. But I managed to, may have repeated one course, but I managed to make most of them the first year. If you get by the first year, you seem like you had a pretty good chance, you know. That killed off a lot. You learn how to study and what to study, and then. So through the 4 years, I had the whole gamut of courses, economics, chemistry, and physics, and all kinds of biology and botany and bacteriology. I was sort of a major in science, so I had a lot of science courses. And the time finally arrived in 32 that I got my cap and a little pigskin, lambskin, I guess you call them, got the diploma. It used to be all made of lambskin, but they call them lambskins. That's what I've heard him called, I mean.
What type of things did they make you learn in the courses, say your botany or the agriculture ones? What techniques were they using?
Principally lecture and discussion. Every professor either lectured, and you took notes on his lectures. If you didn't take notes, why, you would be sorry. And of course, you had a textbook. In fact, all the courses had a textbook, at least one, and lots of references other than that. So you followed the text in most courses. But he would lecture on many things not in the textbook. That was the general theme of the college courses at that time. Very little board work or anything like that, like we used to in the lowest grades. And that was new to me, too, was lecturing and keeping notes and referring to inquiry tests. That was entirely different.
Or in college, did you learn any new agricultural techniques about growing different corns or hybrids?
Well, we learned about them. Yeah, hybrids were just coming in about then. And of course, we learned more of the scientific background of the of growing things like nutrition, plant nutrition, and control of insects and diseases and things. And of course, fertilization. That's principally the things we dwelt on. Proper fertilization and tillage. Of course, it's a lot been added to knowledge since then. We didn't have very many sprays and insecticides and pesticides in those days. Had very few. I might say that when I finished in 33 with a master's, there were still no vacancies for teaching. I prepared for teaching. See? But finally, in second semester of the first year I was out, man broke his leg and I filled in for him. From there, next year I had a full-time job in Worcester County. First county was in Montgomery County, and I taught in Worcester County 2 years. Then I came to Dublin High School in 1936. And I was principal in the school at 25 years old, which I thought was pretty good. 25. Around here, I've been interested in a lot of different things, you know. I'm talking about the later years now. Lions Club, over 40 years in the Lions Club. I was director of the Harvard Memorial Hospital for a period. Tri-State Packers Association. Oh, I can't begin to think of what else. The director of the Savings and Loan Association. Advisor of a bank. Besides my duties at the packing company to try to make ends meet there. It's not easy. Depends on lots of elements to make a profit in the packing business. My son's running that now, since I retired in 75 and then remained chairman of the board for a number of years. But that isn't that part's already known. You're more interested in the old things, aren't you?
Well, we're interested in everything, really, old as well as new.
Well, I belong to the High Island Presbyterian Church and elder there. I belong to the Masonic Order. Remember the shrine? That's the tag you saw on there, on that car, which indicates the shrine number. Right now, we have a little organization going out at Highland. We have a Highland Community Association. We're fixing an old high school up there to serve men in needs. And I'm very much involved in that. We're going to have the post office in there, and then the senior citizens, library, and kindergarten. Not kindergarten, but nursery school. So all those different things are going to be in that area, which the county didn't need a building for anything. They want to get rid of it. Get it off their expenses. So our association is taking that project over and making it a very nice use of that old building, two buildings there. So I'm involved in that and involved in Hartford National Bank in Bel Air. That's about my activities now. I used to have a nice green yard here with a grange, you know. That occupied me a good bit. We've had a dry summer on record this year, you know. Mm-hmm. So crops are pretty bad around here. But we're not as bad as some places down south, I guess. Well, that about winds me down to what I think you want.
as you were a principal of Dublin, what were some of your duties and problems that you had at that school at that time?
All the problems at the school were my problems, you know. Incidentally, being principal was only one title. I was teaching every hour of the day. Back in those days, you didn't just be principal. You were also a teacher in a school that size, anyway. Most of the schools, the principal had some classes. Of course, today they don't, you know. The principal doesn't have classes. The vice principal doesn't have any classes either, you know. But I taught VOAG and the whole gamut, math and physics and chemistry. And whatever else we didn't have a teacher to handle. But that was a nice little school there, community school. Didn't reach out too far, you know. And we had a nice sports program and a nice PTA and what have you there. Far fond memories of that.
After that, during, I guess it would be the Second World War, what type of work were you doing with the government?
That's the interesting thing about World War II. As I said, I was principal during that period. I was the only man in the school, and Mr. Wright, the superintendent, kept asking for a deferment for me. And each 6 months, we never came around, and be deferred again. However, one time I thought we were getting pretty close to needing me, so I went down to volunteer for the Navy, expecting to get a commission. Anybody with a degree would get a commission in those days, see. So I was about 3 pounds underweight, and they wouldn't take me. So I thought, well, if they don't need me worse than that, they don't need me at all, you know. So I didn't go back. Anyway, during the war, I was running schools for repair of farm machinery and canning vegetables, schools in different sections of the county. At nighttime, they were all done at night. I had a siren on my car for air raid warnings. We went around the country and saw that everybody's blacked out at certain times. And of course, we had people who were watching airplane spotters, you know. All this was practiced before anything, you know, in case anything did happen, we were under readiness. Those are the kind of things I did during the war. And I figured I was busier than the soldiers were. It wasn't as dangerous, I guess, but it was pretty busy. Besides having regular class work during the day, regular responsibility at school. So the women worked pretty furiously putting up vegetables from the gardens, you know, and preparing for shortage of foods. A lot of our food was going overseas at that time. I mean, there was a little shortage of food for sale. So we were training those people to can, training the farmers to repair the machinery instead of, because we couldn't buy new. So that was a couple years experience like that, the three. So I did my bit for the service, I think, there.
Or one thing, during the war, since you did have to do all that traveling, how did the stamps affect you? The stamp rationings?
Well, you got stamp, gasoline ration stamps in accordance with your duties. If you had some traveling duties, you would be allotted more stamps. And food stamps, of course, it depends on how many people in the family, you know. But we live with them, and nobody suffered too much. There was some misuse of them. We saw that once in a while, where people they were being stolen, they were being traded, and everything, the stamps, and particularly the gasoline stamps. But we learned a lot from Britain. I mean, the British were over here and telling us what to look for, you know, after, because they had the experience close at hand. We had several British women who were live in this country, went over there to train to tell us what to look for. Yeah, we had a big ocean apart, you know. But ships would get there.
What type of things did you have to look for that they are telling you about?
Well, I think the first thing that rushed my mind is the type of shapes of different airplanes that the enemy had, and how to black out and keep you showing the cities from the air. Now, they didn't have too many planes that fly across that ocean, but there's some, I guess. See, they had to be prepared for the worst, you know. That's principally what they were pointing out, and it's how to make use of the clothing they had and food, different ways to handle the food. That's principally what they brought back to us. World War I, I remember too. You won't believe this. I was 7 or 8 years old when my uncle went to World War I. I remember it just as well as yesterday when he left. And I remember when he came back after Armistice Day, we called it, you know. Now it's Veterans Day, because the armistice never turned out to be the end of all wars like we thought it would. Mm. Yes, I remember both wars, both big wars, I mean, and many little ones. None of them were very small.
On the home front, since you do remember World War One, what were some of the differences on the home front between the wars? Like during World War Two, they had the stamps, while in World War One, they hadn't. Maybe some other things that you know saw that were different?
Well, at home, the biggest difference was communication. We knew what was going on where they were in World War Two pretty well, except the secret parts. World War One, we didn't know where our boys were, hardly. And the communication through mail was very slow, if at all. In fact, I remember my uncle, he weren't even supposed to tell when he left the States to go over. And this particular uncle of mine, he wrote under the postage stamp the day he's leaving, put the postage stamp over it. That's where they looked to try and find it when they left the mainland here. Of course, they went over big carrier boats, you know, ships. And they were very vulnerable with anti, you know, submarines and whatnot. That was the main difference, I think, in the two, and I know, of course, World War II is much more technical. It was mostly trench fighting in World War I.
After the First World War, what was life like in the 20s? Because, or at least our textbooks say, there was kind of like a depression for the farmers anyway, it started. Or did you
yes.
ever see anything?
Yes, it was a lull there in business. The war spending ceased, you know, and that took a lot of the buying power away. So it made things a little bit more plentiful. The price is a little lower for farm goods. Didn't have that war demand anymore. But everything, of course, in that time was pretty much done by hand and horsepower still. Even the highways were readied for with horsepower, with scoops and drags. Wasn't much macadam done, and it was just gravel roads, graded, so the water run off a little bit. I don't know what.
What type of things were happening then with the New Deal and Roosevelt coming in during the Depression? What type of things did he do for the farmers?
Well, rural electrification was the biggest thing, I think, that hit the farm country community area. Rural electrification. Of course, prior to that was the bank failures. I mean, the bank failures and the bank holiday he declared so that the banks get back on their feet again. And at that time, of course, they were insured from there on, federally insured. But, get my line of thought there. The rural electrification was a big deal for the country, way back farmer. They built these lines, electric lines, across, right across the country and brought electricity to the homes of the country people. Prior to that, they used kerosene, and a lot of us had what we call gas lamps. Made your own gas in your basement, you know, your cellar. With acetylene. Most of all the homes had acetylene lights before electric came in. Homes of any size and all. But those that didn't had kerosene lamps. And I remember that rural electrification, REA. And of course, we had WPA and CWA, all the different firms that put people to work. Mm-hmm. And the CCC camps came along there and then for the Civilian Conservation Corps. And that occupied a lot of youth who needed occupying too. Not only occupying, but they needed a little bit of income. Mm-hmm. They got to get a whole lot of income from this, but they got taken care of by food and clothing and lots of good training. I think that was a very successful program, the Civilian Conservation Corps. One thing about it, most all those WPAs and CWAs, at least they worked some for the money. They didn't get much done, maybe, but there was some good projects turned out in those different organizations. Some still in existence, parks and recreation particularly, that the WPA developed and completed. Not to compare what they have today in parks, I understand. But one thing we always gave Roosevelt credit for, he didn't hand money out to people, he gave them a chance to earn it. That's a big difference between today and then. We don't want them to work today, but it's given to them. Mm-hmm. Of course, we do really want them to work, but there's not enough jobs for all of them, I guess. And some don't want to work, you know. We didn't have that attitude much in those days, people not wanting to work. Everybody wanted a job, if they could get one. But that's generally Roosevelt. That's the way I see Roosevelt, you know. Of course, we had him for four terms, you know, almost four. Something like the governor of Maryland. I thought the governor of Maryland was a lifetime job when Albert Ritchie was governor. He was in there 16 years. He's the first governor I remember well. That's a good vivid time in history following the World War I and in the bank failures and the bank holiday and all these working opportunities he produced. That pretty much tells that period of Roosevelt's beginning there.
Did you ever hear anything, I guess, there was the AAA during the 30s, anything about that? I think it was the
Agriculture Adjustment Administration. I can't put my teeth in that, but I remember the letters. Roosevelt was the first one that ever started organizations by lettering them. Now it's very commonplace to hear everything abbreviated by a letter. But your memory gets a little thicker as you get older.
I guess while you're working your 30 years with the packing company, what were some of your duties and responsibilities there, and what was it like then?
Of course, I came into the packing company in 45, and I assigned my job as principal in 45. At that time, we had we were just getting ready to put a freezer in. And that freezer was finished in 46, and it's been freezing ever since. It seems like it's outlived a lot of the canning businesses in the county. Of course, there's not many canning businesses left in the county, or in the state, that matter. We're the only corn packer this side of the bay, I think, on the west side of the shore. But we had trouble, too, of course, getting started in the freezing, not particularly the freezing itself, but the mechanical part of the freezer was new to everybody. Of course, it's all out of date today. It wouldn't think about freezing that way now. Preparing the vegetables, though, for that freezing process was something that wasn't too good a job done on. We were principally selling our product to Campbell Soup, and they were approving what we packed, you know. And they weren't particularly would be today, you know. They had to re-examine all the product, and they got it to plan again. Now they want it in there so they don't have to look at it. They want it completely clean, you know. And we don't sell them as much anymore. We're more independent. We do sell a lot of big name brands, so ingredients for their mixtures, peas, beans, corn, carrots, whatnot. Well, we went through a period of during the war. I mean, the early part of my tenure there was labor problem. We imported a lot of labor from the islands. We had some of the labor and had labor camps and whatnot for them. And during the war, we also had German prisoners, and the German prisoners were very happy to be here as prisoners, but they could outwork any of the people who got in the islands. One German prisoner would do much as two of them. And unless you had somebody off in his rocker, they were perfectly happy to be here until the war was over, you know. And they got paid too. But they were strong and able-bodied and willing to work. And they weren't particularly followers of Hitler, you know. They just couldn't express themselves over there. So labor is one of the things that changed. We used to have labor quarters there for temporary help. No more of that anymore. The help is a little more sophisticated today. And we get mostly local help. We keep year-round people to do the operating the equipment.
Packing industry, what type of equipment did you use to prepare, and how would you prepare the vegetables?
Well, I started to say that in those early days, there wasn't an equipment made that would do a perfect good job on the vegetable. As time evolved, the machinery evolved to where you can count on the machinery doing a good job of separating the chaff from the wheat, you know, so to speak. So today we have equipment that blows and shakes and whatnot and cleans everything out of it, except we give it a final inspection by ladies to be sure that it didn't miss anything. But in those days, equipment hadn't yet caught up with the business, you know. It still hadn't made good cleaning equipment. We can separate the thing that's heavier than the product and lighter. Those two come very easy. One would settle at the bottom and the light would be blown off. So you can get a good separation that way. And we have many more Marcus and Alma did those days. We were principally packing for camel soup, and they were anxious for it then. But freezing had just come in. Prior to that, during the war, they were barreling and salting product to preserve it until they were ready to make their canned soups, you know. And then when they saw a chance of freezers being established, why, they jumped at the idea of preserving it by freezing, then they wouldn't have to do it twice, you know. Prior to the war, we used to cut number 10 cans and dump their vegetables out, use canned goods. But Uncle Sam said no more wasting that tin during the war. The tin plate was getting scarce, so we had, couldn't waste the tin cans. So they went to different ways, mostly barreling corn and icing it and barreling it in, for temporary use and salting it for long-term use. Then they'd have to compensate for that in their mixture. They probably wouldn't have to put any salt in. But times have changed.
When you first opened your cannery, what was the process you used when the vegetables first came in there until they were frozen? What were some of the steps that you went through?
Well, first of all, it was washed thoroughly. And it was blown. But they weren't equipped to blow it right. And we tried to catch the stone in peas, I'm thinking about. When you harvest peas and close to the ground, you get little stones, and you have to get that out, break people's teeth. We had riffle boards to catch that. Today we have the stoners that fold the bottom up and eject them a different way. Then it was blanched. You have to blanch it all, about roughly 3 minutes at about 200 degrees, 195 to 200, along there. And that inactivates the enzymes so that it won't go to keep good. And of course, we had to hand inspect it. But with poor equipment mechanically, it took too much hand inspection, you know. So it was too slow. Right now, they're running corn. I'm going to go to the.
Are you just saying that after they were at the temperature of 195 to 200 degrees, they would hand inspect?
It cooled down, though, after they cooled down again with cold water before it goes on the inspection table. So it won't be too warm from the handle. Then it goes into a cold water pump, refrigerated water pump. It sends it up to the freezer. And this blanch is done about 3 minutes, about 195 to 200 in that area. Varies with the product a little bit. Today there's very little for the women to remove. The machinery does practically all of it. Occasionally I'll see discolored kernel, maybe they'll pick out. But nothing more. Once in a while we run into trouble, like bird damage and squirrel damage along the woods and whatnot. That makes a little brown kernel, you know, where they're eating away. But mostly our equipment will flush that out too. So there's not a lot of in the cutters. Of course, we have to run the corn through cutters. We have automatic huskers. The corn just is run into huskers and takes all the husks off. Then it runs to the cutters and takes all the kernels off. That's all you look for is a kernel. But then you have your problem of maturity. You have various maturities that you have to separate, segregate. Certain markets want one grade, certain markets want another. You have to know where they are in your storage so you can ship the right thing. But that's a business of its own. If it were easy, everybody'd be in it, you know. It's not easy. I say if it were easy living, easy job, everybody would have one. Ours is not the largest bridger, but it's pretty efficient. And it's easy to supervise. It's fixed so you can look right across the whole plant and see what's operating, if it's operating properly. We do a lot of retail trade over there now. People walk-in trade. That's become a larger part of the business now. Not a half of it, but approaching that. And, but a year like this, you have only look at the cornfields and know you're not going to have a crop, you know. So we might have to prorate our orders a little bit. Give everybody a portion of the market. Customers are today. Instead of a truckload, they might get a half a truckload, you know.
Over the years, how has the freezing changed? Do you just, is it like almost a flash freeze, or is there some process in the freezing itself?
Well, first of all, it's changed the process in the way the product moves through. You used to put it in trays and push it in a cold room. Then you had to dump the trays and break up the clusters and so forth. Today, it's frozen on air. Most all freezers today is buoyed up by the air pressure underneath in a cold air, cold room. And it gets shorter all the time, you know. Every person makes a new freezer, makes it a shorter, quick freeze. The flasher the freeze, the better, I think, for the quality. The slow freeze is not good, you know. Bird's Eye, you know, when the first started freezing. And he failed, you know, for a long while before he got it going right. But the idea came from fruit being left at the North Pole, I hear, you know. They found it quick frozen there and it's kept good. The flavor is still there. That's the story I get, in a way. So they found it quick freezing is much better than a slow freeze.
And this is just over air, or is it some type of gases?
No gases, just trough with holes in the bottom, air boosts the product up, and it just likes boiling in there in the air. Separates it, and all the peas come out individually frozen, see that way. Not sticking together. All of our product can pour out after it's frozen. It's frozen before it's packaged. The old freezing, all them, you still have some, like asparagus and a few things like that, you can't freeze and then put in the package because it'd take up so much room, you know. So they put them in fresh and freeze them. But most of the product in the stores today is loose frozen. A few of the old related vegetables will maybe frozen after they put in the package.
Just jumping back a little ways. Before you did go in the canning business, what type of work were you doing with the agriculture vocational school?
Well, we were teaching high school kids about all the things we learned in college, you know. A lot of them, anyway. And each one of them had projects that we'd go and supervise. And they kept records on how much it cost to produce certain things. If they had a calf project, they'd keep records on how much that calf cost them, you know, and whatnot. Whatever it might be. Every kid is supposed to have some kind of a living project. And that was only occupying part of my time. The other part was in the academic courses. Incidentally, I told you I taught in three counties. I was principal. I had several experiences. after I was out of, in the packing company a number of years, I was elected to the Board of Education. Appointed to the Board of Education, I should say, not elected. I served 10 years on the Board of Education in Harvard County, 5 of which I was president of the board. So I've had a wide variety of experiences in my short lifetime. From the one-room school to the big consolidated high school, to the management of them. Well, those experiences on this tape are going to be mixed up a good bit.
Well, that's quite all right. That's no real problem. Or, I guess while you were on the Board of Education, what were some of the decisions and duties that you had there?
What the Board of Education should always be reminded of is that they are a policymaker board, not administrative. Which said policy, but the administrator is supposed to carry out the policies. Follow me?
Mm-hmm.
Once in a while, we get a board member who thinks he should be directing the job a little bit too much, you know. But that's not the part of Board of Education. It's a lay board. They call them a lay board that monitors all the activities of the school system, you might say. They have a policy on all different facets of the educational program, standards and behavioral standards and what have you. Of course, we have the biggest job we have is select the superintendent, you know. That's entirely the board's responsibility. Once you select your superintendent, he hires his helpers, appoints them. Then we hear from all of them what their problems are, and we act accordingly. Well, it's all the way from construction of school buildings to naming them, you know, and all those kind of things. We've seen some of those problems. Every school has to have a name. One time a day, they all had numbers. These little room schools had numbers, too. Numbers in district. I used to write on these things. Everybody had a slate in elementary school. That's the school I attended in 1-7.
Fascinating. I haven't seen one of those.
Force off the slate and start again. We could do long division or math problems on the slate or any other home desk work and take a wet cloth and erase it. Didn't have all this paper to furnish in those days, you see. It was a slate on the desk and also a slate in front of the building, in front of the room, rather. That's the one I attended.
What type of tours did you give to the students, or I guess it would be more recent for field trips around the county? What were some of the things that you would show them?
From the local school, you mean?
Oh, yes. When you give the tours throughout the county, what would you...
Oh, I see what you're referring to. That's the tours to our plant. As you refer to. Any classes wanted to come and witness the process, we would gradually make an appointment with them. So they bring them in by bus and tour the building, tour the process. And we explain to them what we're doing in each station, you know. That's what that refers to.
Oh, okay.
And we have a number of, mostly the elementary grades come as their project to. Each class has the privilege of having at least a certain number of tours, you know. Field trips is the word.
Do you remember maybe any childhood experiences or adult experiences you've had with your family or while you were growing up, like stories or anything else you'd like to share?
Well, I failed to tell you that I was married in 1939. I have two children, a boy and a girl. The son's running the freezer plant at the present time, president of that. My daughter's married to a naval officer. They're presently living in Virginia Beach. He's a commander in the Navy now. So that takes care of my domestic family life. They are both have children, of course we have grandchildren. We started off in 1939, renting an apartment in Bel Air. Then to renting a house and then buying a little farm here. Bought this little farm in 1941. And then we later built, in 1954, we built this house. So everything evolves from nothing to a little something, you know.
During your free time, I guess, while you're growing up when you were young, what type of things did you do there for, like, dances or the music?
About the only social thing like that was different families would have little parties for their friends and classmates, house parties, I mean, at each person's house. And of course, as time went on, we'd have little dances at the school or at the lodge hall or something. I recall when the Knights of Pythias, you probably never heard of them, they used to have a hall at most ever crossroads after lodge. And that was always the center for people to have assemblies in. I remember one up at Shawsville, there's one in Jarrettsville. When I was graduated from high school, we received our diplomas at the Knights of Pythias Hall in the town there, see? There wasn't any auditorium in the school at that time. No big enough room for it. So that's the kind of things that we did for entertainment. Of course, baseball games. We'd work a whole day's work and a half a day to go play baseball in the afternoon. Of course, in high school, we played soccer and very little basketball because didn't have a court, you know. Mm-hmm. But soccer and baseball were the principal things. One's the fall, one's the spring sport we used them. It was pretty rough ground for baseball, too. It didn't bounce truly, you know. So we had a little social life. Didn't take so much to entertain us in those days.
Or over the years, what are some of the changes you've seen, such as in farming, farm equipment, as well as the packing industry?
Bigger and bigger, the main word I'd describe it as. One farmer right now is farming the ground it took used to maybe take 8 or 10 to farm. 8 or 10 families, maybe. We have some big crop growers in Harford County now in a renting ground that used to be operated by the family. So the farms are getting, farmers are getting fewer and larger. And the same thing's taking place in the freezer business and all kinds of businesses, fewer of them and larger. It's the survival of the fittest in the business, you know. If they don't make it, they drop out and then big ones become bigger. That's principally what you see. It's still pretty much family-oriented, however. Only the equipment's larger. They can do more. One person can do more. So we run two pickers. We used to take four to run, see, to get sweet corn in. Of course, prior to that, I should mention, when I first came aboard, the wife back and all the corn was pulled by hand and brought in with little trucks or horses, maybe. Now we've got mechanical pickers go out, and you wouldn't believe you can pick off a sweet corn off a stalk without hurting it any, but you can. We've got these big mammoth four-row pickers that, with air-conditioned cabs and